Territory Podcast. For this episode, we invited Sam Kirchhoff to the show to discuss the recent RV Tools acquisition by Dell and how that ties in with the Live Optics offering. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Hey, thanks for having me, Duncan.
Hey, it's the first time that you're joining us, so maybe you can give a brief introduction in terms of what you do for Dell specifically, and maybe you can also talk a bit about what you did before you joined Dell.
Sure. So my name is Sam Kirchhoff, and I'm the Senior Director of product management, and the products that I manage cover all of the customer discovery and migration software and utilities. And I've been doing that for the greater part of 10 plus years, and it is a derivative really of being a systems engineer in the field. A long time ago, I worked for a company called Equalogic, and we were also acquired by Dell and brought in, and there wasn't really a pattern of understanding how to go about finding customer requirements or providing end users with line of sight to what solution that they actually needed in a right-sized way. And so this was a little bit of a hobby of mine, and it came into a full-time job.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think Equalogic is going to bring up a lot of memories for a lot of my listeners, because I'm pretty sure that a lot of our listeners have been around for ages. So that's awesome.
Well, Equalogic's a big part of this story, to be honest with you. So that's fine.
Yeah, and especially for VMware folks. Now, we actually brought you on to not talk about Equalogic, but to talk about RV Tools and Live Optics. And something was recently announced, and that was the acquisition of RV Tools by Dell. I'm pretty sure most listeners have probably heard about it or seen it on the website of RV Tools at some point in time. But maybe we can start at the beginning. Why did Dell acquire RV Tools?
Well, it's almost one of those questions of, you know, why not? It's nearly ubiquitously used inside the VMware environment. It's a brand. Its capabilities are rock solid. And it was just one of those opportunities where it fit with what we were trying to accomplish, and it fit with the author, what Rob was trying to accomplish. And it just made sense. And obviously, it's very complementary. I know we're probably talk a little bit about this in the future, but you know, part of our discovery offerings that we have out for the end user environment is Live Optics, and I think RV Tools and Live Optics fit together hand in glove. I mean, they're just really, really complementary, and I think that you know, Rob, the author of RV Tools, once we kind of explained what we did and what our purpose was in life, felt like it was also a good home, and so it just seemed like a really good match.
I think a lot of people, including myself, were wondering for the longest time why no one had picked up on RV Tools so far. It's one of those tools that has been used by, we're not talking about hundreds of people or thousands of people, but we're talking about tens or thousands of VMware consultants, VMware administrators that have been using this tool. So it's great to see that, you know, he finally found a new home.
Yeah, I know. Anecdotally, it was interesting in the whole entire process. There was a podcast that you were actually, it was a like a vlog, I think it was, that you were on. And I remember distinct, I don't remember the name, but I remember distinctly where you were trying to teach your co-presenter how to say Rob's name in the Dutch way. But you had made that comment. You're like, I can't believe that one of these OEMs haven't reached out to Rob and made an offering yet. And then I was kind of like, hey, that's a good idea. So yeah, I was in the same boat. And what's interesting about RV Tools actually is that I think actually people might have got confused on who actually authored it. You know, it's well known as a VMware tool. And then sometimes an S gets dropped in there as VMware's tool. And I think that actually helped build a lot of the trust and admiration for it. But in reality, you know, it was just this sole contributor out there in Holland who was, you know, contributing to the whole industry for 15 years. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that people forget is that he had been doing this, you know, basically in his own time, indeed for 15 years, just, you know, day in, day out, just trying to figure out what he can and what he can't improve and listening to the community. So, you know, thanks to Rob for doing this for the past, you know, more than a decade. Now, AviTools, of course, has different types of use cases, and so does Live Optics. And maybe we could talk about that first. So what are the problems that these solutions are trying to solve for customers specifically?
Yeah, that's a good question. I actually think each of the thought processes went about, you know, their development cycles in the opposite way. Rob, with AviTools, what he was trying to accomplish was an administrator's companion. And so therefore, he made different decisions. It was an installed application. It was schedulable. People were able to easily adopt it and put it into their management practices. And of course, the cost was appropriate at no charge. And then Live Optics, on the other hand, was really set about by trying to simplify end users and their planning process, and not really as a day-to-day management. And they both kind of found a home in the opposite direction. So AviTools became very commonly used inside the customer requirements gathering process in Live Optics, because there's also, you know, no license and we don't restrict anybody who's using that, has the ability to go in and use that for diagnostic and day-to-day management purposes, although it, you know, it wasn't designed to do that. And there are time frames that kind of limit its capabilities in that, but there's a market for both of those. And I think each one of them had the same spirit, which was around just transparency around, you know, what do I own? What does it do? What does my workload look like? And then there, you know, was an exchange of that information in whatever way benefited the current situation.
Now, as it's been recently required, I guess one of the other things that people would be interested in understanding is, you know, if you look at AviTools itself, and for those who haven't used it yet, can it still be found in the same place, or where can it actually be found today if it has changed?
No, it's exactly the same. That was one of the commitments that we made to the industry, frankly, and to Rob, which was to keep it stable and available. We look at AviTools almost like an institution in the industry or a museum piece. Not to say that it's a relic, but, you know, just it's valuable. And that was one of the things we wanted to do was to keep it valuable for the end user community. We don't actually know how many end users are out there. We can only speculate because that was not something that Rob tracked. But we know that it's a lot, and we know that its dependency is very high, and we don't want to go break any of those dependencies. So it's still available at the same place. It's still available with no cost. We've even removed the registration at this point. So it used to be sponsored where you had to put in some personal information. We actually removed that off. I even went so far as to buy the URL rvtools.com, which was not owned by Rob. And I actually think it was a recreational vehicle tool website that we acquired rvtools.com from. And that is in the process of being hooked up right now. So maybe that might help from a word and search engine type promotion. But yeah, it's still available. It's the same website. Same cost model, same availability, and it's the same guy writing the code. We actually brought Rob on, and he's a part-time, you know, worker for us, but he's the full-time contributor to the code for AviTools. And so we didn't want anything to change, and we're keeping everything consistent.
Yeah, I think that's great to hear, and especially the cost, because I think that's one of the things that a lot of people appreciate. It was available for free, and you're saying that it will also remain available for free, right?
That's right. Yeah, we have no plans to make it a charge for.
That's awesome. It's also great to see that Rob is still involved in some shape or form. I mean, he's been doing this for a long time. So, yeah, you know, who better to work on this than him?
Yeah, no. And look, that was part of the arrangement, too. I actually flew over to Holland myself and an individual named David Haskett, who's my software engineering manager for all four of the products that we manage. And we almost had to, you know, like verify that Rob wasn't this mythical figure in the industry. So we wanted to make sure he was a human. So we flew over there and met with him. And it was very clear. He's been working on this for 15 years. It's a part of his life. And he wasn't just, you know, letting someone curate code, he was, you know, almost like marrying off a child. And so, you know, we wanted to make sure that we respected that, keep him involved. And frankly, he can be involved as long as he wants to be involved. That's going to be his decision. But I also think that there's just a lot to learn. When one person can do one thing and do it so well, and you have all these companies that spend all this money in order to be able to accomplish gaining market share, there's something to be learned about that and celebrated. And so we need to keep Rob around. We need to learn what he learned.
Yeah, I think that's very valid. And one of the things you mentioned is that, you know, the mythical figure. For those wondering, I also asked Rob if he wanted to be in a podcast. We actually invited him a couple of times. But I wouldn't say he's shy or timid, but he's not the kind of person who is outspoken and he wants to be in podcasts. So that's one of the reasons we didn't have him, but we invited you instead. One of the other things that I wanted to talk about is the tool itself. Now, I've used it plenty of times in the past, not just for troubleshooting, but for instance, I've also been using it for sizing vSAN environments. So maybe you could talk a bit about some of those, you know, different use cases that we have available and how customers are using it today.
Sure. And if you don't mind, I might actually sprinkle a little bit of Live Optics in here, because I think the story is actually really complementary to each other. But one of the things that we found very early on back in that 06, 07, 08 timeframe of bringing virtualization to the market was that the people who were looking at these solutions couldn't really conceptualize, you know, how physical machines would be moved into a virtualized environment. And so there needed to be almost like a composite that was created. And that's actually what Live Optics brought to market. It took in the configuration and it took in the performance and helped create that composite score from a performance and capacity standpoint. Now, RV Tools was really helpful because it already had the definitions of the entire VMware environment. So as you were making migrations from, let's say, like a traditionally hosted, you know, vCenter type environment with a storage array over to an HCI or something like that, you would already have the characteristics and definitions of those virtual machines on file. It's especially beneficial, I think, when you go into a multi-cloud environment, because you're not moving an entire infrastructure. You may be moving virtual machine at a time. And so those are all really critical. But the other one, too, that I think people may not think about as much is in the data protection world. There's this concept of white space, of how much is actually provisioned to the virtual machine and how much is actually licensable from the operating system perspective. And people would historically download RV Tools and they would use the configuration files, especially the ones that came from VM Tools, to edit out this white space and come down to this other mythical figure, which is referred to as front end terabytes, which is the panacea of all licensing calculations and figures and values for data protection systems. So I think it had a lot of flexibility. I mean, information is information, and that was one of the things that I think that RV Tools and Live Optics had in common, which was is that neither one of them was really focused on the vendor or the platform. You're just abstracting details around, you know, what is the workload doing? What is the workload configuration? And what is its portability to whatever the .next generation hosting of that workload is going to be? And that flexibility, I think, allowed the majority of people in the industry to apply it in however they saw fit. And that was core to the value proposition.
Now, one of the other things that I would be interested in understanding is, if you look at it from a future perspective, and maybe you can't talk about this and it's still under NDA, but I think people would be interested in understanding is, if you look at RV Tools, it's a SaaS-based platform. If you look at Live Optics, it's a SaaS-based platform. But RV Tools is just a binary at the moment. Are we planning on making changes to that? So, for instance, making something like RV Tools available as well as a SaaS-based platform, or will it remain the same?
Yeah, to be honest, we don't have any plans around that. There's no roadmap. That was part of our commitment, is that we were going to bring it in, keep it stable. Our number one rule with this whole exercise was to do no harm. And the first thing we're going to do is we're going to study why it was successful. Live Optics is actually a hybrid, and its origin, it was definitely SaaS based. There was, you know, there was a binary, plus there was the SaaS portal. Ironically, as we would go into environments, you know, people would be like, well, why do I need to run Live Optics? Can I just give you my RV tools? so we started to say, hey, there's something to this offline capability where, you know, people can look at their configurations, they can, cut values out to their trust point, and then they can transport the information however they see fit. But I still think that there's value to the SaaS portal as well. You know, the thing that Live Optics brings to the table that RV Tools doesn't have, of course, it looks at other platforms besides VMware, but it also brings in this whole component of performance. And performance is not really something that lives well inside of an Excel spreadsheet, but RV Tools is not gathering performance data. So, you know, maybe or maybe not, there's value to bring it back to the SaaS. You can actually already, and we have been able to for more than a year, import RV Tools outputs into Live Optics, and you can get a report out of that, which is very handy. But I think we might actually see it the other way. We've seen the success of the residential capabilities of being able to do the inventory where, you know, someone can just make a decision, integrate it into their systems. I almost see more value in leaning into that. But I think the reality of it is we're going to spend a fair amount of time studying this so that we don't make a mistake, one, and two, just make sure that there's no disruption. You know, we didn't acquire it to disrupt it, right? We acquired it to keep it there.
Yeah, and I guess one of the things that stands out with RV Tools for probably most people is it is just a binary. You download the binary, you run it, and you collect the data that you need, and you can export the data as well if you want to in any format. So I think the simplicity of, you know, how you use it is probably one of those big things that contributed to the success of the solution itself.
Yeah, it's a true less is more. And one of the big things is just the schedulability. With Live Optics, we were very careful actually to create a binary which only ran in memory and didn't install. And, you know, those are things that we didn't want to get into, just from a testing purpose, just make it light and easy. But with RV Tools, I think that was actually a good decision that he made on his part, was to let it install. And that way, you know, that schedulability, I mean, I know customers that run RV Tools every day and every week, and it puts it down into a file, and, you know, some other system comes and picks it up and does something else with it. We don't have visibility into all that, but that just means that it's very integrated into people's day-to-day lives, and there's value in that, and we don't want to disrupt that at all.
That makes sense. Now, you've mentioned Live Optics a couple of times, and I'm pretty sure that if I look at the folks listening to this particular podcast, it's mainly administrators, consultants, etc. So I'm guessing that a lot of them are probably more familiar with RV Tools at this point than with Live Optics specifically. Now, for those who haven't used Live Optics at all, it's probably good to lay out the foundation in terms of what it is being used for, so what some of the use cases are, and, you know, what it's generally used for by, for instance, a consultant or maybe an administrator if they end up using it at all.
Sure. And look, I'm not going to hide behind the fact of why it was created. It was definitely created to assist administrators and IT planners in the gathering of requirements for the procurement process. I'll just tell you the quick story on this. But, you know, there were people in the industry that were going about sizing infrastructure for end users in the most inappropriate way possible. And that was because the right way to do it was complicated. Okay. So I'm just going to give you a really basic analogy. And of course, this is a podcast, so we can't do any visuals here. But let's just say, for an example, we have one computer or one server, I should say, that has a workload, and it does 500 computer widgets at 8 o'clock in the morning. And then you have another server that does another 500 computer widgets at 3 p.m. Or 1500 hours, right? So what people were doing is normally, because you could just grab the peaks out of these workloads, is they would just add the peaks together, and they were mistakenly sizing configurations for people at 1,000 computer widgets. And what the origin of Live Optics, which a long time ago was called DPAC, did was commoditize a very complicated blending algorithm that took Perfmon and IOSTAT and ESX top data and found a time alignment that said that, hey, we understand that neither one of those peaks of 500 are occurring at the same time. And therefore, we can very confidently and with an extreme amount of validity forecast that you only need 500 computer widgets. And that literally cut the entry point for a lot of these, higher end data center capabilities like virtualization and getting a storage array. I mean, you probably remember back in the day, it was $70,000 for 4 terabytes of data or something like that, something we can get on a thumb drive now. But, I can't even remember the values. It was so far back. But that was really important in that process. And frankly, I think that actually unlocked a huge portion of the industry. It definitely unlocked the capability for people to understand that iSCSI would work, and it affected the Equalogic sales. But we knew that it was working because all of the other vendors in the market started using it as well. And of course, we never really prohibited anybody. But you know, when we had people from the major brands that were out there recommending, that they go use LiveOptics to go gather this data, we knew that it was something that was important for the whole industry. And sometimes you just do things because it's the right thing to do, and for thought leadership, right? So, and that's why LiveOptics has always been no charge. So, just in simple, what LiveOptics is it has grown from that where we used to just measure basically IOPS and throughput for the purpose of sizing a storage array for the validation of virtualization. And we've moved all those same capture techniques and blending techniques into memory and CPU and moving towards GPU, Kubernetes, all this other stuff, because you need to have transparency into your workloads. And workloads are gonna be moving around on a consistent basis. My personal opinion is they'll probably move at even a more rapid pace in the future. And those decisions need to be made in real time, if not algorithmically. And so the capture of this data is actually very important. But the other thing that we saw too, which is really frustrating in the whole market, I had the luxury of being a Dell customer at one point in time too. So I saw it from both different perspectives, but you'd have vendors come in and they would ask you questions that you didn't know the answers to. How many servers do you have? What's their operating system level? What's their performance? And you're like, I don't know. And the person who's responsible for that's not in the room. So it became complicated. And then the dirty part about that whole thing is the next OEM that came in would ask you all the same questions, right? So that's what we wanted to be able to accomplish, was to say, almost from an end user empathy perspective, we're gonna provide you with a way to get a clear visual of what your requirements are for the planning process. And then you're free to share that with the decision cycle. And we provided a secure way to share that so that everyone could be on the same page. You could get a right size, only spend the money that you need to spend, invest where you need to invest. And that's been a part of our process now for a number of years.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that when it comes to the collection of the data itself and figuring out, what an environment looks like, because this is something that comes up with customers all the time. You don't want to know how often I've told customers or asked customers, okay, what does the IO profile of that particular application look like or of your estate looks like? And then typically the answer is, I don't know. And then typically my follow-up is, okay, here's a link, go to LiveOptics, make sure you download everything, get all of the data, and then we can start, exploring what the environment should be looking like. Now, talking about what environment should be looking like, one of the things that I noticed is when I went to the website, and I didn't notice or this before, is that you also have the ability to start doing some cost comparisons as well in terms of on-premises versus public cloud. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. What is the capabilities that were introduced and how does that actually help customers?
Sure. In RV Tools and LiveOptics is both hooked up to this, but it's exactly like combining the workloads together. At this point in time, it's just too complicated for a human to go gather this information and assemble it in a way. And you need a piece of software to go do that. And likewise, we kept having the same scenario where we would listen to our buyers and our end users, and they would say that making decisions from a cost perspective around understanding what their forecasted cloud model might look like was very, very complicated. I mean, there's a 4,000 plus box matrix for every instance and pricing available and on some of these cloud providers. And so what we did is we put a set of assumptions. So those assumptions are static and you can read those in our support files, but we put a set of assumptions together and we go and make the calls to download pricing for AWS and Azure and Google Cloud every single morning. And so those are cached and on file. And every time you do a recording with LiveOptics or with RV Tools, and this is part of the reason of the value of the SaaS system is that when that information gets put in, we go bounce it off that pricing model, and then we come back and we can forecast where these individual workloads might live, which one of them has a better cost model, et cetera. But, and we pull the information back in three different ways. So we get the on-demand pricing, we get the one-year discount pricing, and we get the three-year discount pricing. And we understand that people may have their own discounts and they would just have to apply that to the value itself. But we even took it one step further and we did the right-sizing aspect of it. We kept seeing this trend where people would come to us and they say, well, I don't really know what my first step is. I have a cloud-first mandate. And we're like, okay, well, what does that mean? And they're like, well, I don't know what that means either. Okay, so, but what I think it means is I think I need to take my virtual machines and I need to move them into a public cloud provider. And so we would help them with that rationalization. Maybe that's what it means. Maybe that's not what it means, because people, I think, generally, there's more than one definition for cloud. But we saw a repeat of a mistake, which is, as an IT person, I'm supporting a workload for a business unit. I don't want to move the hosting of that virtual machine and change its configuration in the same move. So most of the time, they would just move the machine up in the most expensive form possible, because you have all that no charge over provisioning capabilities that you're allowed on an on-premise environment. And then they would let it run, for a year and a half, get these extravagant bills. And then they would call back and say, hey, I've got a crazy bill. I need to do something different here. And so, part of this was just allowing people to be aware of what those cost models are. Like, if you move it up as is, we may not be pinpoint accurate, but we're going to give you a very good cost detail of what it might look like. We're also going to give you a cost detail of what it might look like if you went ahead and pulled back some of your over-provisioning. So we try to provide all that. Again, it's transparency. It's just stuff that a human could do, but it would be very complicated and lengthy. And there's just no reason to do it when we can automate it once and make it available for everybody.
In a lot of cases, when we see customers going to the cloud or returning from the cloud to on-prem, it is for particular reasons, which may or may not be cost. But in most cases, from a cost perspective, unless it's the cloud itself, they're not very clear in terms of how much something costs to run. For a cloud, of course, it's obvious because they get a bill every month. But then it's also still fairly difficult, depending on how they actually ended up buying, their estate, in terms of finding out what it actually costs per instance. So I can imagine that this is something that, people would be very interested in. Now, it's probably also good to understand for LiveOptics specifically, because I mentioned there's a SaaS component and you also mentioned there's an on-prem component, or there's a binary component, I should probably say. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how people actually end up using it. So where do they sign up? Which components do they need to download? How do they get it up and running? How difficult is it to use?
Well, we actually tried to create it as a point-and-click type exercise. So the first answer to that is, where do you get it? LiveOptics.com. You can go directly there and just sign up. We did have some basic restrictions in there. It's really designed for corporate level environments, not for people with Google and Gmail addresses and Yahoo addresses and stuff like that. And that's just because we want to be able to keep the cost the way it is, but also for its purpose. It's its purpose is for those planning cycles. But if you go to liveoptics.com, you can just register right there. There's no charge. There never has been. The other way to do it is if you're working with maybe any partner in the world. Or a lot of OEMs, they have the ability to sign you up. And basically what that is, they just register your email address. It creates a one-time account for you. You're given at that registration a startup bundle, which explains what to do. and you can download the latest version of the collector. Part of the reason that we did that actually was because we're in a CI/CD continuous integration, continuous development for those people who aren't software people out there. But you know, we'll post a new collector every couple of weeks, and it has value in that. You know, we get rid of bugs, we put in an expansion of capabilities, and so we wanted to make sure people had the latest and greatest experience. But after that, it's point and click. I mean, it just comes up in memory, and you point it at, let's just say, your vCenter environment, just like RV Tools. Within seconds, we're going to have captured the full catalog of inventory, or in this case, we could also do Hyper-V, KVM, physical servers. We even have collectors for storage arrays, data protection, or even native cloud environments. And all of that is all available to you there. And the one thing that we do, though, that's really different, and I would say differentiates us from a monitoring piece of software, is that we restrict the capture of the information to 7 days. And there's a couple reasons for that, but the primary reason for that is this, we'll talk about the third mythical figure that's out there, is this end of the month workload that people believe that's in their environments. And time again, we have, you know, almost 60 million virtual machines and millions of physical servers that are in our environment. What we find is that the more servers that are in the capture and the longer the capture is, all we're doing to proving is proving to people that their data pattern is more predictable than they think. And in 7 days, in fact, we even have a 95% plus confidence that in 24 hours, we can capture everything we need from a workload perspective very safely. You know, the only reason we extended it to 7 days was just to validate it if we had pushback on that. But that's the one big difference. So you could run it every week if you wanted to, and you would basically have a no-cost monitoring piece of software. But that's not really why we made it. You know, we made it for that decision cycle. We wanted to bring confidence to the market that those decisions could be made at the speed of business. We could capture those workloads, and you could move on with your thought process without overcomplicating it.
Now, you mentioned something interesting, which is the data capturing itself, limited to 7 days. But of course, the data is stored somewhere on top of that as well. So it's probably something that we should bring up, and maybe you can discuss the retention of data from a privacy perspective. How does that actually work with LiveOptics? Is, for instance, someone capable of deleting the data that they've stored within that Dell cloud? Or, you know, how do you process the data? Is data shared in any shape or form anywhere? How does that actually work?
Well, I think we... You know, the catchphrase on our website is collect, analyze, and share. Okay, so the sharing portion of that, I think, is fairly obvious. But we tried to put that in the control of the actual end user themselves. So, you know, the OEMs and the partners aren't the ones capturing the data. It's you as an end user who's capturing that, and you share within your friend circle. Now, up on the SaaS portal, we have what's called data zoning. Okay, so there's a logical separation, even though the data is obviously warehoused on a Dell data platform, but we have this logical separation in there. As far as, you know, personally identifiable information, the only thing that is considered PI or falls into the GDPR space is really just your name at registration. The rest of it is metadata, and we don't actually capture anyone's data. Okay, so we're not reading files and all that other stuff. It's just configuration files, metadata characteristics, little things like, you know, a time value equals 1,130 IOPS or something like that. So it's not overly sensitive, but you do have the capability of deleting that. You'd have to open a support ticket for that. But I think in general, one of the things that I should point out is that anybody who interacts with Dell, all of this falls under the same umbrella. Dell has a privacy policy, which is very well written out and published, and you're free to go read that. But one of those things that's in there is what you mentioned, right to delete, you know, right to understand, et cetera. We're very sensitive to that. We only get what we need for the decision cycle. We're not any more aggressive than that. In fact, there's ways for you to actually use the software without ever transmitting anything to the SaaS portal. So the SaaS portal is an opt-in, not a mandatory. So basically any collection that we have, with the exception some of the storage platforms, which, you know, we're talking about having to upload like gigabytes of information because the complexity of moving through those files. We do reserve that horsepower for the SaaS portal, but almost anything with the virtual machine, the cloud, you have the capabilities of doing an inventory only mode, which would be nearly identical to RV tools. And that stuff all just stays resident in your environment.
Now, one of the other things you also mentioned a couple of times is that there are various OEMs actually using Live Optics as well for their own purposes. Now, I also know, of course, you have a partnership with VMware where VMware actually utilizes it for what they call the VMware HCI assessment. Maybe you could talk about that as well. Is that actually the same as Live Optics?
No, it's the same. I mean, we created different profiles inside Live Optics. We have, you can sign up as an end user. You can sign up as a partner of an OEM. You can sign up as an OEM yourself. And, you know, what we did is we gave the capabilities, if you're a partner or an OEM, to replace the company interface, you know, so the Dell portion of that with their own company. And we know that the relationships are between people and the people that they do business with, and we don't have a problem with that. But the agreement with VMware was definitely interesting. And yeah, the VMware HCI assessment is Live Optics true and through, right? With the exception of a few replacements of some graphics and stuff like that. And, of course, that helps them in their motion. So if you're doing business with VMware, that's what we created the platform was for you to be able to capture this information, share, get on the same page, and make decisions together in real time.
Now, before I let you go, I think one of the things we're also interested in understanding is, because it's definitely something that we see in the industry, is the move towards cloud native. You've already alluded to it, but maybe you can talk about that as well. What kind of level of integration do you have with all of these different cloud native platforms? So we're talking about things like Kubernetes, containers, etc.
Yeah, this is actually a good question, because you don't. This almost goes back to the very first philosophy of how we wrote Live Optics to begin with, and that was that we wanted to be hardware and platform agnostic. The reasons for that were very specific to the time, but it ended up being a really good decision going forward. Now, enter the whole cloud platform market. We do have an AWS native and an Azure native capability to go and do discovery on those environments. But the reality is that all of the, unless you're doing something special, you know, trying to get like the storage workload or trying to get like the relational databases or Elastic Cloud or something like that, the instances, which are by far the most popular thing that people want to get information around, are really just virtual machines that are running an operating environment. And so you could actually use the host-based collection methodologies that we have in Live Optics. That's called Optical Prime. We have something called inventory mode. We also have something called rapid discovery, which is something that is relatively new. Optical Prime was really designed to be pointed at physical servers that were attached to a storage array to profile, you know, what the storage workload was, or a vCenter environment, and profile that particular performance workload. Rapid discovery is totally offline, inventory only, and it's designed to go and discover hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of endpoints in a very smart way. And there's a credential manager in there, which will let you do deeper configuration grabs for Linux and Windows. But when we use something like rapid discovery, we're talking about being able to discover, you know, maybe 100,000 endpoints in less than 10 minutes, right? And what's cool about it is it'll get anything with an IP address. So you've got somebody's phone, a camera, a network printer, you know, whatever's on there. You'll have to go sort that out in the background, but it's popular amongst the network administrators. I would say since we put it out, it's probably our third or fourth most popular scan that's out there. And like I said, all of that stuff just comes down in an Excel spreadsheet, just like RV Tools does. But it's hardware and platform agnostic. So as long as it can communicate on the network, you can even do multiple subnets. So, you know, for example, let's just say you had 10 different subscriptions on a public cloud provider, or even different public cloud providers. So you could run rapid against those as long as you had IP connectivity or hosted up, you know, on one of those individual virtual machines, and, you know, almost instantaneously, you're going to know everything that's out there. You would not believe how many times, and this led to the creation of Rapid, where people came to us and they said, we just don't know what we have, right? With the growth of businesses, the sprawl of virtual machines, mergers and divestments, people lose track of this information. And we want to be able to provide this as part of their administrator toolkit, just like RV Tools was super successful in the VMware World toolkit. You know, we want to provide a whole catalog of those. And I think that's why the blending and the marriage of bringing RV Tools and LiveOps together was such a good move.
Thanks, Sam, for a very interesting episode. Any famous last words or anything else you would like to plug?
No, I'm not a plug, but I'll give you one line. This is my team hates when I say this, but I think it's the it wraps all this stuff together. And the phrase is that you can learn a lot from dissecting a frog, but the frog has to die. Okay. And what I mean by that is that you can overcomplicate anything. Our job in this whole thing is to donate to the industry and give capabilities which gives you the answer, right, without having to go through and actually kill the frog, right, and make people's lives worse. We're trying to make things simpler. It's an opt-in process, but those are words for us in our software development world to go live by, and it's our philosophy, and you should see it on our software. So I hope that it's recognized.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to those frog-friendly stickers or t-shirts.
Maybe that'll be the next thing we make. There you go.
And that's it. We've reached the end of another episode of the Unexplored Territory podcast. If I have to summarize today's episode, then my key takeaway would be that RV Tools and Live Optics do not only provide insights in what workloads you're running and what these workloads are doing, but on top of that, they also enable you to determine how to optimize for cost and performance. Again, thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and rate the podcast wherever possible. If you have any feedback, send us a message on Twitter or @UnexploredPod. Last but not least, I would like to thank Sam for a fantastic episode.